Cruz's premiere of Walking with Herb is coming later this month. And today, Joe Bullock and Ross Marks join us to talk about the making of the movie.
All of these lines are being crossed over.
Herb, Joe, Mob Leon.
Joe, I get you to trust and believe. Your part is to turn all of that self-doubt into faith.
What's the mission?
Yes.
Every major on the planet will be gunning for the $3 million prize.
Win the golf championship of the world entire.
Meet me at the Artesia Country Club, bright and early.
Coming in to finish the sign-up, Dave.
You haven't played in years.
35, to be exact.
Now, JoJo, hit me a nice fade.
We'll tee up right after NPR News, and you can call with your questions, 575-646-2212, to be a part of Voice of the Public with Ross Marks and Joe Bullock, next on KRWG Public Media. Noon, and welcome to Voice of the Public on KRWG Public Media. It's 106. This is KC Counts. Happy to have you along, and so happy to welcome Walking with Herb writer Joe Bullock and movie director Ross Marks. Welcome to KRWG, gentlemen.
Hi, Casey. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thanks, Casey.
So glad to have you today. And we can spend the next hour talking about the making of Walking with Herb, both the story, the novel, and the movie. And there's lots of territory to cover, but I want to begin with what everyone wants to know and needs to know about the Las Cruces premiere of the movie, just a couple of weeks away now. Ross?
Yeah, so the film, our fish, it's not only the Las Cruces premiere, it is the world premiere. So we're really excited about that. Originally, the world premiere was going to be held in Los Angeles, but due to the virus, it could not be held in Los Angeles. So I'm very proud that the world premiere is in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where it belongs, because the film was shot here. It was born and bred here. Everything about this film is a Las Cruces film. And on April 29th at the Amador is the world premiere. It is sold out, so there are no longer any tickets available. However, April 30th, the movie opens nationwide in over 2,000 screens, including the Allen Theater's Telshore Drive-In. So for about 3 weeks, the Telshore Drive-In will be playing the movie, and you can see it there, or you can see it in El Paso at the Cinemark Theaters. Or for those listeners who are not in the Las Cruces area, you can see it pretty much at any major city or town throughout the U.S.
Well, congratulations to the both of you on what I know, Joe, for you is so close to your heart. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how this story began for you?
Well, it always been on my bucket list to write a book. And it relates a lot to my own personal story, to my relationship with my dad and with golf. I just kept throwing ideas into a file until I had enough for a book. And I was lucky enough. I wrote a story about my dad years ago. It was published in Golf Digest, which kind of got me started thinking I could write a little bit. And Martin Medoff helped me with that. And then Mark has shown me a few things about creative writing. I've always done a little bit of writing, but never for the public. And it was kind of a labor of love. I've always enjoyed golf and all to me, golf is like a microcosm of real life. All things go on a golf course. It's a place to test yourself out, kind of a bloodless arena to try things that whether they work or not. You know, you don't want to try something mountain climbing or skiing or parachuting that may not work. But in golf, all you're going to do is lose your ball. You're not going to get killed. So I've always thought that golf is a great analogy for those kind of things. And the book just kind of came together, just changed it. I think if you've got a story that's worth telling, it tells itself once you start. You know, that's the case on this one.
And what was that story for you?
It was a message. I wanted to send a message to people that their most of their limitations and doubts or fears are self-imposed. You've got all this baggage that keeps you from doing things, and you can do a lot more than you think you can. Without being preachy, I'm a pretty spiritual guy, and I do believe that we've been equipped to do more than we are doing. And in this story, God's a little disappointed in us for underachieving and settling for average lives when all of us could do so much better. And that's the point of this. And it teaches some life lessons in it about allocating your time better, One of the things I points the book I like to make is that it encourages people to trade wasted time for wonderful time. And by I mean wasted time is when you sit there in front of your TV set from 9 o'clock to 11, just, you know, in a kind of a stupor watching some sitcom or something like that. You know, go to bed then and wake up at 4 o'clock and warm your fresh and get something done. And that's one of the lessons I try to teach people.
Good lesson.
And I do that myself. I get up 4 o'clock every morning.
Ooh. Well, wow. I used to do that, but I'm happy not to do that anymore if I can avoid it.
Yeah, so the 1 o'clock interview, you're getting close to Joe's bedtime, Casey.
Well, before I let any more time go by, 575-646-2212 is the telephone number to call. If you have a question for Joe or for Ross or for both of them, please call now and be a part of Voice of the Public this afternoon on KRWG Public Media, a chance to just really dive into the experience that they had along the way. You mentioned that you got some help, Joe, writing from Mark Medoff. How did he help you?
Well, he just helped me structure. I remember when I wrote that story about my dad's in Golf Digest, Mark read it and said, you know, it's good, but you didn't tell people how you feel. They want to know how you feel. And so I went back and took that advice and redid the ending of it. And it, I think it really made the whole story a whole lot better. It's kind of a funny thing. I sent this thing into Golf Digest, just encouraged them to maybe support a junior golf club where I was trying to develop. And the editor of Golf Digest, Jerry Tardy, called me about 2 days later and says, I love this story. Has it been published anywhere before? And I said, yo, you're lucky. This is one of my few unpublished works. and we made a deal. He just loved it so much that he ran it in their Father's Day edition of Golf Digest back in 2011. But if it hadn't been for Mark's input to make it just a story, but a feeling, it would not have been nearly as good. And Mark also kind of taught me to be concise and he was trying to tell me the difference between a screenplay and a book. And that, you know, in a book, you tell people what happened. In a screenplay, you show people what happened. And I remember I came back with what I thought was a pretty good screenplay. And he looked at me and says, Joe, you wrote another book.
Now, give us a sense of the time frame when this was going on.
I started working on the book probably, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and then started putting it together in 2015. And I got one of the things I did that was trying to be a very, very smart thing to do was I got endorsements from people who were in the same genre or had some relationship to the book. And I sent them copies, got them to write me some very nice endorsements for the book. And one of the most helpful was Ken Blanchard, who, I don't know if you recall him, he wrote all those One Minute Manager books, those things, sold millions of books like that. And he wrote one book called One Minute Golfer. He's a very avid golfer, but he called me. Not only did he get endorsed, he called me and gave me some advice about publishing. He said that you should go to and have it self-published by the independent publisher. He says, if you send this to conventional publishers, you're just going to get a stack of rejection lists is all you're going to get. So he gave me a recommendation, some ones he'd used, and I sent to one of them and got a lot of good help in structuring the book and how to do it. So that was very helpful. But I just very glad I had that idea to get those endorsements, because it really made the book kind of a little bit different when you've got people endorsing it, like Bernard Langer used to be number one golfer in the world, and some other famous people. And so it was
Craig T. Nelson.
Craig T. Nelson in the acting side endorsed it. Lou Henson endorsed it. Shaquille O'Neal's coach, Don Brown, endorsed it. Charlie Johnson endorsed it. We had a lot of
Mark Medoff,
Bill Rogers, who's number one golfer in the world, won the British Open one time. So a lot of really good endorsements that really, I think if somebody picked up the book, they say, gosh, looks like some pretty well-known people read the book and liked it.
Did you know from early on that you wanted it to be a movie?
I think every writer fantasizes about that. I suspect they all do, because, you know, if you're going to get much traction, it's going to have to be a movie. People don't read that much, especially unknown authors' work. And I was just thrilled that Ross looked at it kind of coincidentally. In fact, why don't you tell that story, Ross, about...
Well, yeah, I mean, I did a movie called The Hard Out Right, and it was screening in El Paso. And I was driving down to El Paso listening to Howard Stern, a radio story, right? And I was listening to Howard Stern on the radio on Sirius. And I was getting kind of numb from his negativity. And I said, I can't take this negativity anymore. And I started fiddling through the radio, and I got Joel Osteen, the preacher. And Joe was preaching this message of positivity, believing in yourself, trusting in a higher power. And I thought, you know, I really like this. I should make a movie about what he's preaching, a faith-based movie, something good. And I remember reading Joe Bullock's book a year or so before and thinking this would be a great movie. It's a faith-based book. It's about trusting and believing in God. It's about golf. I've always loved golf. So I called Joe the next day. I said, what do you think about turning your book into a movie? And he was thrilled. And so began the process of adapting the book into a movie. So the first thing I did is I took the book and opened it up and started adapting it page by page and did a couple drafts and then showed it to my longtime mentor and partner and father-in-law, Mark Medoff, who was an atheist. So I knew he wouldn't like it, but I asked for his feedback. I said, hey, I wanna make this into a movie. What do you think? And never in a million years would I have expected that Mark said, I love this. You're fired. I'm the writer on this. And anytime you have an Academy Award nominated screenwriter, a Tony Award winning playwright who says, I want to write your movie, the right response is yes, thank you. So Mark took over to screenwriting and did a beautiful adaptation. And in fact, the best, very best part of Walking with Herb, and we're going to talk a lot more about the movie, I know, is that Mark, over the process of writing the screenplay and working on the movie and facing his own death, because Mark died during the post-production of the film, God rest his soul, Mark became a believer. He found faith. He found hope when it didn't exist. So I think this being Mark's last project was really wonderful because it brought peace to him. And again, it brought faith and hope. So the film, I think the film people are going to really respond to it. I think audiences are going to love it already. The response has been great. But the response that Mark had to the film is the most rewarding and meaningful for me.
Yeah. Joe, who did you imagine would play you in the film?
Well, somebody not very attractive for sure. I've been told all along I've got a radio face, Casey.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, the Thirsty Pod mine was Craig T. Nelson, because he'd endorsed the book. He was about the right age for this. And then Mark had the wonderful idea that being the culture we have in Las Cruces, that we could, and there's a real disconnect, I think, between the number of Hispanic moviegoers and the number of Hispanic stars, especially in lead roles, especially in roles where they play good guys instead of some kind of a gangster or something like that. And Mark had the idea to make the two first role Hispanic. And that was a wonderful idea. And Joe, and you couldn't find a better person for this role than Ever J. Olmos. Just there just couldn't be. And if that Ross could speak to how casting works and how you almost never get your first choices. And how we're so fortunate.
Yeah, do you just bring out your little black book of actors and start making calls?
So the way, and this was unusual in this film, the way, this is my fifth film, you put together a list, which is a wish list. Here's who I want to play this role. And you usually go about 20 deep. And you start making offers. You send the script to number one, and they usually pass, can't do it. And usually you're around 8 to 12 before you get a yes. But in doing this, like I said, I've been directing and working in the entertainment industry for 30 years now. Your number one never says yes. In this particular case, I knew Eddie Olmos from my work on the Las Cruces International Film Festival. So I had his personal email. I sent him the script on a Friday. I said, hey, we wrote this for you. You're our first choice. We're shooting on this date. You know, would you do the film? And shock of all shocks, Monday morning at 10 a.m., I get a call from him saying, yes, he wants to do it. So that never happens where your first choice says yes. And then our first choice for the co-lead, the character of Herb, the angel, the messenger of God, was George Lopez. And I figured there's no way George Lopez is going to say yes. We're going to be around, you know, number 10 on this one. And George immediately loved it, responded and said yes. And I remember calling Joe and I said, you're not going to believe this, but our first two choices just said yes to do the movie. And that never happens. I said, we must have a good film on our hands.
Joe, I mean, it is a funny picture of George Lopez playing a messenger of God. Not necessarily something that you would think would fit together. Tell us a little bit about Herb and your story.
Well, Herb and my story, the name came from my old college golf coach, Herb Wimberly, who, if you've been around a lot, he's pretty iconic in the golf world here. He was the only golf coach University had for like the first 27 years of the program. And he said, I still sit there next to church and we'll go out and play nine holes every once in a while. But he's such a wonderful person. Everybody in town just loves him. And the role model is kind of a mixture of Herb and my own dad. The character in the book, and there's a lot of lessons that my dad taught me that Herb imparts to the protagonist, I didn't have to search too far for the names of the protagonist's name, Joe, which is after me, and then his wife's name, Sheila, which is my wife's name. So, and we had a dog named Tootie, which was our dog's name, so I didn't go too far in life for stuff with names. But yeah, if you know Herb Wimberly, you know a lot about the lead character of our story. Although in the book, as Mark would do, shooting the movie, Mark takes things from a darker place, a longer journey for the protagonist, and also adds more flavor and color to the Herb character, which is George. You couldn't find a guy to pull that out any better than George did.
We're watching George in the trailer of the movie riding a Harley through the pecan orchards. Now, did George actually manage to pull that off?
So when we were casting George, I said, hey, your character rides a motorcycle. Have you ever ridden a motorcycle? And like every actor, he said, oh, yeah, I know how to ride a bicycle. Of course, I'm a good motorcycle rider. Well, it comes the first day of shooting, and we're out at the what cemetery was that?
Woodbine? No. What's the one out there?
We're shooting at a cemetery.
Yes. Yeah.
And his character is supposed to drive in on a motorcycle. So George is in makeup and costume, and I go over to him. I say, "Hey, we're going to shoot you on the motorcycle. Do you want to warm up? You want to practice?" And we had hired a motorcycle expert to make sure he was okay and to train him and to watch him. And George said, no, just, you know, when you're ready, I'll pull up on the motorcycle. I don't need to practice. So, of course, we get there. I say, action. And George comes pulling up on the motorcycle, skids to a stop, falls over, the motorcycle falls over, and I'm like, oh, okay, we just lost our actor. He's going to be injured. He's going to the hospital. And we rush over to him. He says, I'm okay. I said, listen, let's practice this for a little while, and then we'll shoot it. So you go practice. I'm going to go shoot something else for the next couple hours while you practice riding your motorcycle. And then George, after that, because he was riding a great big motorcycle. It was an Indian motorcycle that Indian had sponsored the film. And George, from that point forward, would practice every day because they realized how hard it was. And there was one scene, like as often happens in the movies, you shoot some of these scenes that never make it into the movie. But there was one scene where he was riding on a highway and doing turns and twists. And we were shooting him riding the motorcycle. And he did a great job. And I scheduled that for the very last day of shooting so he would be the most experienced of riding the motorcycle, and unfortunately it didn't make it into the movie. But at the beginning of the film, George could not ride a motorcycle, but by the end, I think he was ready for the track.
I'm really glad I asked.
Stuff would move you over anyway.
Right, that's true.
I'm sorry, Joe. I think I stepped on you when you were just saying what was that you said?
I thought Ross scheduled that last scene with George on the highway, so if he killed himself, it would have most of the movie in the can anyway.
Right, that's true.
I imagined that either George was, in fact, a pretty accomplished motorcyclist, or you just had a stunt double do that part. So that is a way better story than I thought we would get.
Yeah, no, and the other thing is we cast an actor named Billy Boyd, who's well-known for Lord of the Rings. And Billy Boyd was supposed to play an elite golfer, a top number one golfer in the world, the world's greatest golfer. And so I talked to him. I said, Billy, can you play golf? He says, oh, yeah, I can play golf. I said, are you good golfer? He says, I'm a great golfer. I'm a scratch golfer, which means he's as good as it gets. He's a great golfer. Well, Billy comes down to the set And he heads out to the first tee, the first time we're shooting Billy on the golf course. I said, hey, listen, just hit a long drive, you know, 250, 270, you know, down the middle. And Billy takes a club, and I knew right away with seconds of his backswing, he was not a golfer. And he hits the ball, and it flies. He slices the heck out of it. And I turned to him. I said, you're not a golfer, are you? And he just gives me the smile. And I said, okay, great. Now how am I going to film this guy who's really not that good of a golfer and make him look like the world's greatest golfer? But thankfully, through some movie magic, we pull it off.
It's good to know that even, you know, already famous people can fake it till they make it, right?
That's the number one rule. If somebody asks you if you can do something, say yes, and then Google it, figure out how to do it.
575-646-2212. It's 125. This is Voice of the Public on KRWG Public Media. And we are joined today by Walking with Herb writer Joe Bullock and Walking with Herb director Ross Marks. Ross, I wanted to talk a little bit more about your father-in-law's involvement in the film. You know, obviously, you two had worked together a lot previously. Was this a different experience for you and for him?
It very much was, because we knew Mark was ill. We knew Mark had cancer, and he wasn't working as much as he normally would. Mark wrote, I met Mark when I was 19 years old, and he, like I said, he started out as my mentor and then became my father-in-law and then became my partner. And so Mark and I worked together for many, many years, and he would write 8 to 14 hours a day religiously. He loved writing. He was unlike most people who write with the hope that somebody reads it. He didn't care. Mark wrote for himself. He was a true writer. And when we were doing Herb, he was declining in health more and more and more. And so Herb kind of kept him going. It kept him alive for a longer period of time because he wanted to work on it. He came to the set as often as he could. Mark, if you know Mark, anyone who's ever worked with Mark knows he loves to rewrite. Most writers, you say, hey, I need you to change this or do that, and say, oh man, okay, and they do the rewrite. When you say to Mark, hey, we need to rewrite, he gets all excited. You know, writing is rewriting, and Mark loved rewriting. And in fact, Mark wasn't a writer, he was a rewriter. He was always rewriting. But the film really kept him going, kept him alive, brought him to a place personally of faith and hope, so that on his deathbed, and I'm proud to say I was there on his deathbed when he took his last breath, there was some peace there that I don't think would have been there without the movie. And I'm so proud of the fact, and I hope people go see the movie, because I'm very proud of the film. And the last thing you see on the movie is in loving memory of Mark Medoff. So the film is dedicated to Mark. Edward James Olmos was very close with Mark and loved Mark and his work and had met Mark in the early 80s, and was also so proud to bring this film to life. But I think it's Mark's best feature film. You know, Mark, obviously Children of Lesser God was a great film. But I think in some ways this is has more of Mark in it than anything he's done.
And Joe, you mentioned your dad a couple of times. Tell us a little bit more about your dad and the lessons that he taught you.
Well, my dad's an unusual fellow. When my twin brother and I were born, our mother died. And there was my dad, about 34 years old, with two older children and two brand new baby boys. And a lot of people have been bitter and thought the life had just dealt them a real bad blow. But he kept us all together. He had a great sense of humor. He married a wonderful woman 2.5 years later, our stepmother, who just a wonderful woman. Did it. Can you imagine somebody marrying a widower with four kids and a bad golf habit? And she married into that deal. But she just, we all, my dad raised us a lot of humor, a lot of love. We had a family feed store. There was a lot of good old manual labor to do, throwing sacks on trucks and milling, mixing feed and stuff like that. So grew up working alongside him. And my dad had a great ability to compartmentalize. When it was time to work, you worked hard. When it was time to play, you had fun. And he had the perfect force, and had three boys and himself. And we'd go out and play golf. And my dad was a legend. He won the Artesia City Championship how many times? I grew up in our little town of Artesia. And won a lot of other fairly good sized amateur terms down there. Back this before television was big, and so the whole town turned up to watch a local golf match. and Dad was just a very very good player. He could even when I was playing on the college team, he could beat me. And did and loved it. But he was a wonderful guy. He lived. The story I wrote about him for Golf Digest was called Dad's Last Shot. And what happened, Artesia decided to build another 9 holes to their golf course, to make an 18-hole course. And because my dad had been such an iconic member of the club and had given them free advice on how to take care of the course, they wanted him to hit the last ceremonial shot. And he called me, and he was nervous because he hadn't played in a while. He wasn't feeling good. So I got care of the night before, and we had a little lesson. Got him where he could hit the ball, and then we had a beer and talked about old times. And the next morning, we got this ceremony, all the crowd around, and I walked Dad up on the first tee to hit, and you can tell he's nervous. So to break the tension, I do this little Babe Ruth pointing over the fence gesture down the fairway, and Dad kind of settled down, and he hauled off, hit about 250 yards right down the middle.
Wow.
And then he died about 2 months later, but that was just the whole town was rooting for him. Everybody's glad he didn't die. So.
And you were proud of your dad.
Oh, yeah, always happy.
575-646-2212, the telephone number to call. If you have a question about walking with Herb, now is your chance to ask Joe Bullock and Ross Marks, or both of them, and we'd love to have you along for the show. We have them until 2 o'clock this afternoon, so call now with your questions. And, oh, you can also comment or ask a question on Facebook. We're joined by Ross and Joe today via Zoom. So if you're watching along on Facebook, thank you very much for joining us there. Find us at KRWG, and you can comment or ask a question there. We're happy to take your questions that way as well. And so let's get back to now to the making of the movie, Ross. When you decide, yeah, I'm going to take this project on, you know, give us a little bit about the steps that you, I imagine you have to find money first.
Well, I mean, very first thing, if you're going to go make a movie is get a very good script. That's the first thing. You can't make a good movie without a good script. You can make a bad movie from a good script, but you can't make a good movie from a bad script. So I knew that we had to get the script right. And so Mark and Joe and I worked very hard to get the script into really good shape, where we felt that the next thing you want to do once you get a good script, which helps you attract the financing, is attach actors. So you want to get actors to attach. So it's a lot easier to raise money saying, hey, I've got this good faith-based film with Edward James Olmos and George Lopez, and saying, hey, I've got this good faith-based film with no actors attached. So we attached Eddie and we attached George. And originally we had a single financier who wanted to get in the faith-based film business, and the financing fell apart. And I remember, you know, Joe and I were both, you know, disappointed and kind of deflated that, you know, hey, it looks like our movie is going south all of a sudden, but we had these two really good actors. And Joe said, you know what, this is a great script. It's a faith-based script, which is something that's very marketable today, because the faith-based film audience is bigger and bigger every day. And we've got two great leads. So we've got a faith-based film. We've got two huge Latino leads. There's a golf element. So there's all these really nice marketable elements. And you never go into a movie thinking, hey, I'm going to make a lot of money. You just want to make a good movie and hope that you know, the money follows. And Joe said, well, let's raise the money ourselves. I think we can do it. It's a good project. And we met with, you know, about 20 people and said, hey, we want to go make this movie, and we've got these actors, and it's a faith-based film based on Joe's novel. And everybody we met with said, I'm in. I want to do it. I want to invest. And it became another wonderful part of the film, because most of the investors, there were a few from Artesia, but most were from Las Cruces. And it was, again, just more it just made the film an even deeper Las Cruces project. So it was written in Las Cruces, directed and financed in Las Cruces. And I think Joe can talk a lot more about that.
Well, yeah, we were fortunate enough to have a good elements to work with.
Yeah.
And a lot of good, solid people that we know that had faith in what we were doing, and in this nice investment group that's all hung together. You know, we've had the disappointment of the COVID thing putting us at least a year behind where we thought we were going to be by now. We, in fact, just everything went so well. It was kind of shocking when in March of 2018, we had a United Artists had loaned us their big screening room.
No, March of 2020.
I'm sorry, 2020. I'm sorry, yeah. G was wrong. Well, yeah, March of 2020, United Arts had loaned us their big screening room, and we had, I think it was 76 at the time.
No, we had 119 people coming.
119 people, all the Hollywood buyers, and it's going to be there.
Distributors.
It's going to be like a one-film film festival. And that was the week that COVID just shut Hollywood down, and they've been shut down since then. And so, but that was disappointing. But everybody hung in there. I hadn't had one investor yet say, "Hey, Joe, where am I going to get my money?" And they've all hung with it. Now we're at the point where the fun part starts, I think. And we're having this premiere here. We're also having the world premiere is here in Las Cruces. The Eddy County premiere is going to be in Artesia, New Mexico on May 8th. We're going to show we have a deal over there with about 300 people showing up as a thank you for all the help that they gave us. And but everywhere we turned around, people were willing to help. You know, Royal Jones, that's just the golf course, and all if catering needs, things like everything just went just as well as it could, except for the COVID delay.
Yeah.
And Eddie almost did an interview, and this is a guy who's made probably 70 films, and said this was the best experience he's ever had working on a movie.
Wow. Did he say why?
You know,
I'll answer that. It was because of Ross.
Yeah, there you go.
Ross is one of his early mentors, a guy named Gary
Marshall.
Marshall told Ross that the director is in addition to getting all the technical part right, you need, like, you're the host of the party. You make sure everybody's having a good time. And to a person, every one of our actors just tells us this is either the best or one of the best experiences and the most fun they've ever had making a movie. And you can, it comes out in the performances.
But
Ross is too modest to take credit for that. I
was very blessed. I had Gary Marshall as a mentor, and as Joe said, he said, you know, when you're directing a movie, you're hosting a party, and if everybody has a good time, it'll be on the screen, and if they don't, it'll be on the screen. So make sure that people enjoy the film set. So I worked very hard to achieve that. When Eddie said that he has the best experience he ever had, again, if the film doesn't do well, but it's got to do well, and I promise Joe would do well.
What do you think were some of the things, Ross, that you did to achieve that?
Well, I try to maintain an environment that's conducive for creativity and collaboration. Film is the ultimate collaborative medium, and I'm the type of director where if somebody asks me a question, whether it's the cinematographer, a grip, a gaffer, production design, costume design, they said, "What do you want?" I bring them into the process and I say, "Well, what do you think? You know, how do you think we should do this? What would you like to do?" And so I make them feel and take ownership in the film as much as I have. And in working with the actors, you know, even someone like, Eddie Olmos, he would say, "Well, how do you want to do this scene?" I would say, "Well, Eddie, how do you want to do the scene? You know, what do you think? What works for you? Let's start there and then figure it out." So it's about collaboration. It's about encouragement. So when something goes well, always pointing out, "Hey, that shot looked great," to the cinematographer, "Great job. This looked great. Thank you, everybody." I would often bring the entire crew together at the end of the day and say, "This was a great day. It was a wonderful day shooting. Thank you so much. I want to, you know, thank you all and see you tomorrow. Thank you for working so hard." And going, I heard a story also when I was a young film student that George Lucas on the first Star Wars movie would go up to all the crew members, the most important to the smaller crew members, and just say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." So I would walk around the set, I would thank every single person on the set. "Thank you for being here. Thank you for helping. Thank you." And so I just made people feel, that they were appreciated and that they were, their opinion and their contributions were extremely valued. And so I think that paid off with having a really collaborative, upbeat, high-energy film set.
I think Ross's style also was a perfect fit for George Lopez. because, you know, George is so instantaneously, spontaneously creative. But I swear he did some of those things as he's walking into the scene. I think the idea came to him.
Yeah, like that. George is great. You know, he's so fast and quick-witted. He would improv a lot. And I remember early on, the first scene we did together, he said, "Do you mind if I improv?" I said, "George, I cast you so you would improv. Please improv." I said, you know, and the other thing I do with actors that I firmly believe, and I teach this at New Mexico State University, is that the script has to work for the actor. The actor doesn't work for the script. In film, in the theater, it's very different. In theater, when an actor's cast, they have to get the line exactly right. And if they want to change the line, they do need permission from the playwright. But when you're making a movie, I believe it's very actor-centric. So the script has to work for them. So if the line isn't quite working and the line happens to be, "Hey, KC, it's great to be on your show," but you want to say, "KC, I love your show," then that's fine. If that makes it the actor take ownership and they're more comfortable with that line, then that's the way you go.
Yeah, could you say that again one more time? Joe, I wanted to ask you, how much time did you spend on the set?
Well, I have a full-time job. My board of directors kind of expect me to be at the bank now and then. But I tried to get there almost every day. It's been a couple of 3 hours. And I kind of thought my role out there was to be kind of a cheerleader, walk among the extras and pat everybody on the back and thank them for being there. You know, it's kind of cold weather when we were shooting. It wasn't a typical warm October in Las Cruces. And a lot of people were put in some fairly miserable conditions out there. And so I kind of made myself a self-appointed cheerleader for the crowd, walking around thanking people.
I remember that. That was very unusual for us, and I was really feeling for all you folks that were, because we wanted Edward James Olmos and George Lopez and everyone else who came to town for the project to see our town during its most beautiful time of the year, which is normally October. But they toughed it out. And Joe, what were some of the things that really surprised you along the way in terms of turning your story into a film?
Well, it just... what Mark did, he took the story. I kept telling people, I brought a lump of clay, he made a statue out of it, okay? And just the way that went. And the professionalism of these actors. I remember in the book, the Herb teaches Joe a special way to putt, a little different putt. Eddie, instead of going out and playing golf and having a good time, he wanted me to stay on the practice putting green for 2 hours working on that. To he really had that technique down. And this probably didn't exactly respond to your question. One of the things I really was grateful for was when Mark would call me over and talk about the screen. First of all, I was flattered that he'd want some ideas. You know, we'd share ideas. But we came up with the idea that one of the ways to get our audience to root for our character more was to have him, instead of just also playing for himself, also be playing to save a homeless, a daycare center for homeless kids. And that got to be a part of the script. And now here we are. Our premiere is going to go to benefit Hardeen. How cool is that?
Very cool.
Full circle. It was a very, you know, everything was kind of surprising, to be honest with you. I mean, my next movie will be my second one.
Your next what?
My next movie will be my second one.
Are you already working on something else?
Well, we got lots of ideas.
We sure are, yeah. We're ready to go. We got a couple other projects that we're developing right now.
Well, I'm excited to hear more about that as soon as you can tell us. In the meantime, Russ, how far did you have to look to find the talent, the skilled workers that you needed to be here to make this movie?
Well, the after the screenplay, the next hire, and then the actors, like I said, once we have a good screenplay, you get your lead actors on board. And then the next thing is your cinematographer, because film is a visual medium. So the director of photography is really important. I'm very blessed that I have a colleague that teaches with me at New Mexico State University named Mitch Fowler. And Mitch and I have done a dozen projects together now. I've done everything since I've moved to Las Cruces with Mitch. So that was really easy. I just picked up the phone. I said, "Hey, Mitch, we're going to be making a movie in the fall. Tell Animus you can't teach. We're going to be making a movie." And Mitch and I spent a ton of time storyboarding and shot listing and getting the visuals ready for the film. Then I went up to we've got a wonderful community in Las Cruces, and the film community is growing every single day, but we don't have the crew based quite yet to fill a feature film. So I had to go up to Albuquerque and interview and meet with a number of people up there to work on the film. Our set was 68 people. So we had 68 people working on the film. I'm really proud of the fact that of the 68, 24 of them were New Mexico State Creative Media Institute graduates and alumni. So I was really, really, that was rewarding, is to be on set of a movie like this and see my former students on the set with me. That was really enriching and exciting. We also had an internship we ran for our students. So we had 32 CMI NMSU students interning on the film on the set. So, you know, about probably half the crew came from Las Cruces. The other half came from Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and a few people we had to bring in from Los Angeles. But it was a great crew, and everybody worked hard and did a great job. And it starts with, really starts with Joe. He's got such a good attitude. And like you said, he was a good cheerleader. And, I think that's why everyone enjoyed the film set so much.
And Joe, you just mentioned briefly earlier, your wife. Tell us about her role in all of this through the process.
Well, my wife is a wonderful person. She taught kindergarten and first grade all in the same room for 20 years. And then she helped with Aprendamas, taking care of developmentally delayed infants. And so she's a real caring, loving person. She's very supportive of me and encouraging. And her and Kathleen Quinn had buddied up. You know, Kathleen's playing shooting, and they buddied up, had some good times talking together. But she is just a real warm-hearted person. And Ross is blessed with a wonderful wife, too, Deborah.
Sure,
I couldn't ask for a more supportive wife than I've got. And she takes... she doesn't get too upset with my bad sense of humor sometimes, or odd sense of humor, I should say.
She's used to it, I imagine.
Oh, my God.
Now, did she read your book first?
Yes. she I made her.
Did she offer you any suggestions along the way?
Yeah, she did. She's a... the book is very average type guy. The protagonist is just a very average type guy like myself, and you want to make sure that's part of the story. How an average person can achieve very good things, great things.
Yeah. We have a comment on Facebook I'd like to share with you from Gina, who says, looking forward to seeing the movie. I got to meet Joe Bullock in person, as well as Edward James Olmos. My grandson, Santiago, was one of the extras who took part in this movie, and it was a thrill for me to take him every day and be close to the action. There was a lot of Las Cruces youth who got to be involved in this project. And Ross, what were you hoping that they could take away from that experience?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I'm an educator. I'm a professor at the Creative Media Institute, and I work hard to inspire and excite people about film, which is my passion. And then when I get to make movies, I kind of, you know, put my money where my mouth is and show people that, you know, yeah, what I teach I can actually do, and it is a great medium. And so the more people that we could bring on the set, and we had hundreds of extras. There's in the film credits, I think I put thank you to our faithful extras, and you never list the extras in a movie. It never does that. But I, you know, we shot at the Red Hawk golf course for 11 days in 30 degree weather, and we had hundreds and hundreds of people standing there in the crowd. So I made sure to list every one of them. So if you were an extra in the movie, your name is in the credits, because I'm proud that you supported us, and I'm grateful. Joe and I are grateful for your support. In fact, one of the projects Joe and I are working on is a kids movie, kind of like Stand By Me, where we'll be casting kids. So, you know, the energy of young people, I see it in the classroom. It really drives you. And to have that on a film set also really elevates your game a little bit. So it's a pleasure to have young people, because they're so creative and so inspiring and so exciting to be around. You know, the world is full of possibilities when you're young. When you get to be a little bit older, it narrows for you. So when you surround yourself with young people, you just, you know, there's you're surrounding yourself with energy.
And honesty.
And honesty, yeah, absolutely.
We just have a few minutes left. I can't believe it. 575-646-2212. Joe Bullock and Ross Marks behind Walking with Herb with us here today on Voice of the Public. And Ross, obviously, it was just last month, if I'm not mistaken, that you held the film festival, and that was a very different experience for you. How did things work out?
You know what? It's very well. I was surprised. We had 7,500 people attend virtually, which is about 5,500 more than I was expecting. So I was really surprised and delighted that we had such a big turnout. And I think it speaks to the fact, once again, of how supportive this community is. The community not just supports me as a director and as an educator, but in terms of the film festival, we get so much support. I can't wait to do it in person. I hope I never have to do another virtual film festival, because it's just not the same. And my dear friend Russell Allen, poor guy, the theaters have been shut for over a year now. So I can't wait for March of 2022. We've got some huge things planned. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to be in person at the Allen Theater, celebrating, watching movies together, partying together, the way it's supposed to be. But the virtual festival went very well.
Are you going to carry any elements from that virtual festival into the future?
We're considering screening the films online after they screen in person. But I'm a big believer in the movie going experience. I think it's so important. And like Joe said, in terms of Walking with Herb, when COVID hit and we were told by a number of distributors, hey, we're out of the distribution business because theaters are closed, you're going to have to stream it. And we had a number of streaming offers, but we held out hope and we held out the belief that we could figure out a way to get it into the theaters, because I think that's the way movies should be viewed, is in the dark on a big screen with surround sound with neighbors. So we fought and scrapped and found a way to get this film into the theaters. And I'm so excited that April 30th, Walking with Herb is premiering in movie theaters all around the country, not on your laptop, not on your living room television, but in movie theaters. And then a few months later, you can watch it on your laptop and on your television. But first, see it in a movie theater.
Well, how did you ultimately arrive at this date being the right time to move forward?
The date was tricky because theaters had to be open. But if they were too open, so if we were to release this in the fall, there would be no theaters for us, because all the movies that have been waiting for theaters to open fully would take all the slots. So we had to find a time where we could release the film that theaters would be open, but not too open that all the big studio films would take the slot. So we picked this April timeframe because enough theaters are open, enough people are going to the film, two movie theaters to support film, but it's not the crunch, the tidal wave of the studio films, which is going to hit really, really hard August, September. And it's also right after Easter. It's right after the Masters Golf Tournament. So people are thinking about golf. People are in a kind of inspirational, spiritual mind frame. So we felt this would be a good time for us.
Joe, do you have a good time watching the Masters? I'm just making an assumption that you might have watched the Masters.
Yes, I did. It was pretty exciting. That's my favorite thing on TV all year is to watch the Masters Golf Tournament.
Well, you referred earlier to it as kind of as bloodless, but there was it Rory McIlroy who hit his dad right in the knee? Which one was that?
Yeah, well, it's usually not bloodless. It usually is bloodless for the participants, for the spectators, maybe not. Maybe not. So, but in the book, the tournament is the Masters in the book, and that he goes and plays in. And so,
what do you think, Joe? This project bring to the community of Las Cruces?
I think it brought a sense of pride that we've actually done a movie here. You know, in Las Cruces has been the film set for a lot of movies, but it's been placed somewhere else. It's not Las Cruces. It's the story somewhere else in Las Cruces, just substituting for that location. This is where, it, by golly, is Las Cruces. And Las Cruces is mentioned many times in the movie. You can see it's in our teach in Las Cruces. This brought a nice economic burst of money into the community for all the expenses in on living. And a lot of, I think, waking people up there, we can do things here in Las Cruces. And I really salute Mark for what he's trying to do at the university with the Creative Film Institute. We're creating jobs that will exist in New Mexico. You know, we educate a lot of people in this state to leave and go get a job somewhere else because that job doesn't exist in New Mexico. I think Mexico's got a real future in the film business. And, you know, Netflix up in Albuquerque, all filming scenes that the government's given us. And I think that Ross is doing something wonderful here that's going to provide jobs for people who want to stay here and work here. So.
Well, obviously, COVID impacted everything except Amazon along the way, right? But it made us wonder, you know, what will come back and what won't come back. But I think in the film industry, you kept seeing indications along the way, and you can speak to this, Ross, of growth. Even continuing during the pandemic.
Yeah, there's where there's a will, there's a way. The productions did shut down for a period of time. I shot a short film in November on a COVID safe set, which was difficult and challenging. But one of the things that opened up was more and more streaming avenues, more and more online distribution platforms. So in some ways, the film industry actually expanded. And in, like I said, the fall, late fall of this year, theatrical distribution should be probably close to 75% of what it was pre-COVID levels. So there should be more opportunities for an audience to see films through the increase. You know, I mean, everybody's gone streaming now, right? You know, NBC Universal's got Peacock, Paramount's, you know, and I got Paramount Plus, Disney's got Disney Plus. You know, everybody's doing their streaming model, but they're not abandoning the theatrical model. You know, Warner Brothers with HBO Max. So, you know, the good news is there's going to be more content. You know, the more streaming avenues there are, the more distribution avenues are, the bigger the need for content. The bigger the need for content, the more opportunities there are for filmmakers like myself and my students.
And do we have that? Was it in the Go Bond? There was a new soundstage for Las Cruces. Talk about what you expect to see from that.
Well, we're working on it. It's not quite realized yet, but we're working on something called the Mark Medoff Creative Campus, which would house the Creative Media Institute. It would house the Creative Media Technology Program at DACC, and it would also have a professional soundstage. So it would be an opportunity for professional filmmakers to work alongside students to work alongside professional filmmakers. And it would be a place that would bring the entire community of Las Cruces together to generate these types of projects. So it's not quite there yet. There's the funding was put together for the DACC component. We're still working on the NMSU CMI component, the professional soundstage. But I think over the next few years, I think we'll get there, and it'll be something that'll generate a lot of film and television revenue down there.
Joe, thank you so much for spending this hour with us today and for telling your story. What story are you going to be telling next?
Well, we're working a couple. I've got a couple of mine, but I think they're secondary to some better ones that Ross is looking at right now. And I'm really excited about the ones we've got in the hopper right now. That I think that we thought we'd be already doing them by now, but with COVID, we're not. But it's just wonderful to be a part of this creative team we've got here. And I really look forward. This is going to be my retirement job.
He'll work harder in retirement than he ever did in the banking business.
Well, you did mention you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every morning. What do you do at 4 o'clock in the morning, Joe?
Well, I do some exercising, a little spiritual activities, some meditating, and plan my day. I always tell people, you know, even an average guy can do pretty good if he gets a 2-hour head start on everybody.
Well, and I want to thank Kim Wood, who said on Facebook, this was such an enjoyable listen. Thank you. Ross, with the minute or so that we have left, let's just make sure we didn't leave anything that people want to know out.
But like I said, I think that Joe touched on it, and this is the important thing. Most of the time when film crews come down to Las Cruces, they're supposed to be shooting in Arizona or Texas or Los Angeles or Las Vegas. We actually wrote a movie about Las Cruces that takes place in Las Cruces. Edward James Olmos' character is from Las Cruces. The film, everything about this film is Las Cruces. It's a tribute to what I believe, and I know Joe agrees with me, and I know the late Mark Medoff agrees with me. We believe Las Cruces is the greatest community in this country, and our way of saying thank you to Las Cruces was making this film, and I hope everyone in Las Cruces gets a chance to see it and participate in our gratitude.
Yeah, and looking forward to the world premiere, of course, already sold out at the Amador on the 29th, but it surely is going to be a phenomenal event. Will we be welcoming Edward James Olmos to the party?
Eddie will not be there. George Lopez will, however, be there. So Eddie's a little COVID wary travel, but George is braver.
All right, maybe he'll ride that Indian all the way.
Right. I think you can take the motorcycle from LA.
All right, Ross Marks and Joe Bullock and Walking with Herb today on Voice of the Public. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Casey.
And coming up next, it's Intermezzo by Request and Leora Zeitlin on KRWG.